You know, when people hear the word bankruptcy, they think they think liquidation, going out of business, disappearance. What's the case with bankruptcy under federal law?
When a Chapter 11 case, which is what this would be, is filed, it's not about liquidation. It's about restructuring the affairs, giving creditors of the estate an opportunity to come together, work with the debtor, work under the supervision of the court to start over, to get a breathing spell, allow everyone to come together and figure out who is entitled to what and where the assets that might be available to compensate the creditors will come from.
So the media is reporting that the Buffalo Diocese has now been named as a defendant in 221 sex abuse cases filed under the Child Victims Act. How would a Chapter 11 bankruptcy affect the prosecution of those cases?
So for the cases that have already been filed, they would be stayed upon the filing of a Chapter 11.
What does it mean to stay them?
To stay them, they would be suspended in the court where they are proceeding. New cases would not be filed. Instead, all of those cases would be consolidated, brought together for resolution in the bankruptcy court.
Okay, and the bankruptcy court is a federal court.
That's right.
And a case would be supervised by a federal bankruptcy judge.
A federal bankruptcy judge. So in Rochester, we have the bankruptcy judge in Rochester supervising those cases. We are fortunate in Western New York to have some really outstanding bankruptcy judges.
A lot of people want to know, does the diocese actually have to be insolvent? I mean, does its liabilities have to exceed its assets in order to even get into bankruptcy? Does there have to be a determination of that up front?
No. It under the former Bankruptcy Act, that was the case. Insolvency had to be proven. Since 1978, the Act of 1978 was passed, all you need to have is some form of financial distress. We're having that one form to consolidate everything will help expedite the resolution of that distress.
Now you've referred to the automatic stay of the litigation. Now, let's say you've got lawsuits that name the diocese. They may name an individual parish. They may name an individual priest as defendants. Who gets the benefit of the automatic stay in those cases?
Only the entity that files gets the benefit of the stay. That it applies only to the debtor in the case. Any related entities to get the benefit of the stay would have to file themselves, or there would need to be some other order that would be entered to temporarily stay actions where they might affect the bankruptcy.
And if the diocese files, let's say day one it goes in and files a bankruptcy petition, what happens? What's the sequence of events from there?
Okay, so after the stay is entered, the stay isn't entered really to benefit the debtor. It's entered to benefit everyone in the case, to give everyone an opportunity to come together at once. The concern in many cases, particularly in mass tort cases, that you'll have what we refer to as a race to the courthouse. And you will have a lot of different filings in different venues, and it can be very difficult to manage all of those cases, and it can be, especially when you have a community that's trying to heal, if you have multiple cases going in multiple forums with many different people doing different things all at once. If you consolidate them in one forum, that allows you to bring it all together, and then what you're trying to do in that case is really decide two big things with respect to the claims themselves. First of all, how big is the pie that will be available to compensate them? And then second, how do we determine who gets what out of that pie? And in deciding those questions, you will have representatives for different interests who will be empowered to speak for those groups in the bankruptcy case itself. So there will be negotiations, there could be litigation where those negotiations aren't fruitful. But altogether, you're trying to work toward the common end of sorting out how are we going to address the financial aspect of this issue.
And how does a creditor in that case get to understand what the extent of all the liabilities are and what the extent of all the assets are?
Well, there are several things that are available in bankruptcy and are really streamlined in bankruptcy that you would not have in other forms. So one of the obligations of the debtor is to be transparent. Bankruptcy doesn't work if a debtor is not transparent. A debtor has to be transparent about where their assets are, what their liabilities are, And you're required to file a schedule of who your creditors are, where your assets are. It's a very detailed process. And having put together many of those when I was in practice, it is a very long list and it's one that you take very seriously because you want to be sure you get it right. That is one of your main obligations as a debtor, is to be transparent.
What are the consequences of a debtor being less than transparent or lying or hiding things in a bankruptcy court?
Well, at the extreme, you could have a trustee appointed to manage the estate, which nobody would want. That can be more costly, and it can also disrupt the ultimate goal of resolving the case. Less extreme, you could have a bankruptcy examiner appointed who's responsible for examining what the debtor has been doing and making sure that the transparency has in fact been there, and where there hasn't been transparency, to report to the court concerning why there was not transparency, perhaps, and the matters that were being concealed.
And the schedules that are filed, those are signed under penalty of perjury, are they not?
Yes.
So that's a federal crime.
Right, and that, you do not want to commit bankruptcy fraud. That's another story.
You know, Michael in his remarks talked about releasing the records. Are creditors going to be able to get the records of relating to sex abuse claims in the bankruptcy case?
Well, there are certainly avenues for, it doesn't operate the same way as discovery does in normal litigation. But there would certainly be opportunities to obtain access to information. And again, you have different parties who would be working together to manage how that would function. One of the first cases that I worked on was the Enron case several years ago. Now it's ancient history. It's shocking me how that happens. In that case, there was a bankruptcy examiner appointed, and that examiner was responsible for managing the detailed examination of exactly what happened in that case. And that report was very thorough, and because someone who was independent and really interested in getting to just laying out the facts for the court, someone who didn't have an interest in the case otherwise, it was one that was very well received and helped, everyone come together, move past the disputes about who was doing what and where money was going.
There have been, as I said, 20 diocesan bankruptcies now, or religious order bankruptcies in the United States that have dealt with sex abuse claims. Are there lessons in those cases for us from what you've been able to see?
Some of the lessons are really lessons that you would see in other bankruptcy cases as well. When you go in, every case is different. You can say that there have been 20 diocese bankruptcies, but every case has its own unique issues because there are unique individuals involved and unique situations, unique circumstances, different. Even one diocese may have this structure, another may have that structure under a different body of law. And those can all raise some interesting questions. If the goal is to make sure that everyone comes out of this process with achieving the basic objectives that we would all have for a bankruptcy case, then those cases can move fairly quickly. Most of these cases have moved toward resolution within a couple of years.
We had the bankruptcy in the Diocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, the Archdiocese there, took about 4.5 years and involved upwards of 400 claims, mm-hmm. Sex abuse claims, but ultimately they got that resolved at the end of, in the last quarter of 18. So would 4 years be a realistic time frame, do you think,
or would it take? That's been one of the longer cases. The first three cases that were filed in 2004, I think there were a couple that were over 2 years, but one resolved in less than a year. And it really depends on what happens. As we've both practiced corporate bankruptcy in the past, we know how things can come up that surprise you and might delay a case or take a case a little longer. And thankfully, a lot of the legal pathways have already been carved, in other cases. So some of the issues that might have delayed this case or that case, we have a source of reference to look to help address those questions up front in any case that's filed now.
So one of the assets that the diocese may have would be claims under insurance policies that may have existed at the time. Well, they may cover these sex abuse claims, and there are different kinds of policies. Can those claims against the insurance companies be pursued in the bankruptcy court?
Well, the way that would work is there would be typically an adversary proceeding filed. What an adversary proceeding is it's an actual case that runs parallel to the bankruptcy case. So if you think of a bankruptcy case as kind of an administrative process with some litigation that involves how we're going to carve up the pie and what size the pie is going to be. The adversary proceeding is a related piece of regular litigation that is addressing some very specific issue. And so if there is a dispute with insurance companies, then you could have an adversary proceeding that is filed in the same jurisdiction. In other cases, we have, in other mass torts, we've seen that those cases were allowed to proceed in a state court and have the insurance questions resolved there, and then whatever assets were, whatever conclusions were reached in the insurance litigation were funneled into this fund, which again, I'll just refer to as the pot.
Because we've seen in other diocesan bankruptcies, the insurance coverage ends up being a very significant part of the pot.
I think it's about $400 million or something in the cases that have been concluded to date. It is a substantial number.
So how do let's focus on the claims of sex abuse victims. How do those claims ultimately get resolved in the bankruptcy court, practically speaking?
Oh, that's a great question. There are a lot of different ways that it could go. The typical process in bankruptcy is if you have disputed claims, unliquidated claims, when the case is filed, you might have just ordinary claim litigation, which is a summary process, which isn't like normal litigation. Given the nature of these claims, that's not what would happen. What you could have some resolution system set up. You could have a settlement criteria established, negotiated, that would streamline the determination of who's entitled to what. Or you could have individual settlements through the course of the case. There are different avenues, and it really depends on what the parties in interest, as they work through it, decide is going to be the best route.
And so I wrote last Sunday in the Buffalo News about Ken Feinberg, who's a lawyer and has been named as an administrator in some mass tort situations, some bankruptcies, but sometimes outside of bankruptcy. So what does a Ken Feinberg type person do to resolve claims?
Well, one thing that you would try to do is first get to an agreement on what is going to be sufficient for someone to put forward to prove their claim. The difficulty with a lot of these cases, as in the asbestos cases of 30, 40 years ago, is that the actions that led to the injury are decades old. And some of the witnesses, some of the people who can speak to them are no longer with us. Some of the files might not be in existence anymore. And so it makes it very difficult to prove them through an ordinary litigation process. But what you can do is come to an agreement about what kind of representations have to be made, what kind of evidence is going to be sufficient to sign off on a particular claim. And those. And that, again, because you have different parties who are working together to resolve the matter, representatives of plaintiffs have an opportunity to say, you know, these standards are going to be too high. Look at the situation for these claims. We need these standards to be at this level so we can move forward and we can actually start to heal in this process.
Okay, so now the big issue on a lot of people's minds is all of the entities within the diocese and the effect of the bankruptcy on them. So you have the diocesan central corporate structure, and then we have individual parishes of the diocese, which themselves are separately incorporated. Mm-hmm. And as you said before, the automatic stay would not apply to a parish. So litigation could continue against the parish, but has that happened in diocesan bankruptcies, or do they get resolved together?
Typically, what your goal is, if you're really pursuing the litigation, there are going to be different goals. You know, of course, there's the transparency goal that many litigants come in with, you may have some who are going to try to proceed based on the feeling that transparency is not forthcoming in the bankruptcy case. You can address that by being transparent in the bankruptcy case and working together. If there's also confidence that you're working together to get to an expeditious financial resolution of these cases, then you may be able to have more of an agreed approach, where we'll agree to suspend these cases and not work on this or that, so that we can come together and really make this work. So there would maybe legal avenues to extend what is kind of commonly referred to as extending the stay, but really is just the entry of a different temporary injunction to freeze everything to give everybody an opportunity to come together. Those are somewhat controversial, but that might be an avenue if sideline litigation is becoming too disruptive.
So in some of the bankruptcy cases, maybe all of them that have been resolved, the diocesan cases, I've seen reference to a term, a channeling injunction, that's entered at the time that a plan of reorganization is approved that resolves all of the claims. What's a channeling injunction, and to whom does it apply?
Sure. So if you think of the automatic stay as a temporary injunction, when a case is confirmed, and what we mean by that is at the end of the case, we've put a plan forward to all creditors. Those creditors have had an opportunity to vote on the plan, had an opportunity to object to any provisions of the plan that are objectionable, and after all of that process, it's been approved. Once that has been approved, the court enters an order confirming the plan of reorganization. That confirmation order then replaces the automatic stay. So you can think of the automatic stay as a temporary injunction, the confirmation of the plan becomes a permanent injunction. Now, what you can have in some cases, particularly where there might have been some kind of tail liability or some claims that are unknown and haven't been resolved in the bankruptcy case, is a channeling injunction. And that's kind of a shorthand for saying actions going forward will not go against the reorganized entity. They will go against a separate entity that's been established and to control the pot, to control the fund. And so any future claims or any claims that have not been resolved during the course of the bankruptcy case, that's where you go to look for your financial recovery.
Okay, so to get back to this issue then of the parish, if if a parish has been named and there's some demonstrated liability along the way that say a priest was at the parish and that the parish wasn't supervised or something. Are the parish assets then at risk in the bankruptcy case?
In the bankruptcy case, probably not, in the sense that we would think of it as being swept into the bankruptcy case. They would have separate claims against the parish if they have this, and so they would be at risk in the regular tort system. Where you could have assets and those liabilities resolved in the bankruptcy case is if there is some kind of bringing together of those assets, some kind of an agreement that in lieu of making these other entities file bankruptcy, they will contribute funds, and in exchange they will be covered by the discharge or the channeling injunction, not the discharge, but the channeling injunction, and so they would be protected in that way. But there's an exchange that goes on there. You're giving up your assets, you're giving up perhaps defenses and other things that you have in the tort system, but in exchange for giving those assets, putting those assets, contributing assets to that trust, you are the beneficiary of the channeling injunction.
And in fact, that's how it's played out in some cases. Parishes have contributed to the pot and then have gotten the benefit of the channeling injunction. So one of our attendees this morning came armed with a question, which I was happy to see. They said if the parish gets sued and there's liability, What about what I assume are unincorporated entities within the parish, a Holy Name Society or the Rosary and Altar Society, that may have accumulated some cash through fundraisers and it's being held in the parish account? Are those assets part of the parish assets?
Well, I have to admit my ignorance of canon law and how those operate outside of bankruptcy, but how that operates outside of bankruptcy, who has rights to what those relationships are, if you can pierce the veil, as we would refer to it in corporate law. All of those would be issues that aren't technically bankruptcy issues, but their resolution under this other body of law would, of course, be respected in the bankruptcy case.
Okay, and then the one that came up many times at our listening sessions in the diocese was, what about funds contributed for specific purposes? So let's start with the funds for Catholic Charities.
It really comes back to the same answer. It's if you are looking at funds that have been contributed for a specific purpose, then the question would be, what would be your ability to access those as a creditor of this entity outside of bankruptcy? If you wouldn't have the right to proceed against those assets, say for a settlement where they're voluntarily contributed and made part of the bankruptcy case, then bankruptcy doesn't give you any more authority to go after those assets than you would have outside of bankruptcy.
Okay, and in the general principle in those kinds of cases is that where there's a separate corporate entity,
right,
and the formalities of corporate law have been observed, you know, they're not treated, for example, as a mere instrumentality, and there is a separate board of directors and they hold regular meetings and there are segregated bank accounts. Generally, that kind of corporate entity can be shielded. But then you're right, there is litigation where they try to pierce that veil,
right,
and to make the arguments, the opposite of the arguments that I've just suggested.
Right, you didn't follow the proper formalities, you did not respect those formalities. That would be one way that you could pierce the veil. You could also have questions that, well, this entity was really set up as a sham, or these assets were transferred improperly and might have claims about fraudulent conveyances where you moved a lot of assets in order to take them out of the victim's reach. Those have been raised more, I think, in corporate bankruptcies, where companies have attempted to get out from under some defective product or something.
What about the restricted endowment of the diocese?
It really falls the same way. I mean, if there's a restricted endowment that has a contribution for a specific purpose, we would have to look at how does non-bankruptcy law treat that, and the ability of a successful creditor to actually go after those assets. I hesitate to speak to the specific endowments here because I just don't know enough about them to really kind of dig deeper into how this would work. All of these questions, though, are things that one of the great things about bankruptcy is parties who have an interest in exploring this have avenues for doing that in bankruptcy. It's not about protecting one entity. It's about respecting the rights of the different entities that are involved, at least with respect to determining financial rights and obligations.
Okay. While the bankruptcy is pending, what happens to the various ministries of the diocese? Do things continue to just operate as they were?
So if you look at the Rochester bankruptcy, you'll see those of you who are familiar with corporate bankruptcy, you'll see many of the same types of orders that are entered, or motions that are entered on the first day. These are motions that are intended to, just by its operation, I'll step back before I talk about those. By its operation, there are certain things that a bankruptcy filing would do to freeze how the entity operates. And these motions are all part of one big picture saying, we need to be able to do this, we need to be able to do that. And those motions are typically designed to ensure that your operations are not suspended or interfered with. And so in these cases, what you've seen is services are held, schools continue to have classes. And it's because that's not the objective. The objective isn't to shut everything down. The objective is to keep things moving forward while at the same time providing a path for the resolution of these particular issues.